We are back with On Second Thought on GPB. I'm Virginia Prescott and Bettina Love, who wants American public education to push beyond getting students to just the next grade. Her new book, We Want to Do More Than Survive, argues for dismantling tweaks to curriculum and testing that perpetuate inequality in schools and the nation. The former public school teacher, now UGA professor, is calling for more radical reforms, which she compares to the abolitionist movement. In a recent column for Education Week, Bettina Love questioned whether white teachers are culturally equipped to teach in America's public schools, where more than half of the students are not white. And she's joining me now in the studio. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Bettina.
Well, thanks for being here. You look at things in a very wholesale way. But let's talk a little bit about your day-to-day. You're teaching students at UGA's Ed School to teach. What do they say when you ask them why they want to do it?
So, you know, I think there's an idea that white teachers can't teach black kids. And so they walk in with those perceptions. And for me, I don't believe that. I believe if you are trained well and you are thoughtful and you have life experiences. And so the first thing I do is I ask my students, why do you want to teach? And many of them say, you know, because I love kids. And you got to understand, UGA students are like Ed students around the country. They're smart, they're thoughtful, they're kind, they're very respectful, but they have not been challenged because many of them have lived in bubbles. And so what we try to do in schools of ed, and particularly at the University of Georgia, is try to challenge them and get them to think outside the box. So you saying you love children, that's great, but that's not enough, particularly to teach students of color, because you don't need to just love them. You need to love their culture. And that's what I really try to get at in the book, and it's not, and in the article, and it's not to say that white folks can't teach black kids. Of course they can. But you got to be knowledgeable, and it's not just about you caring about us. It's about you caring and loving our culture.
So you ask them to also guess which percentage of black people, what percentage of the U.S. population are black people. How do they generally respond?
So the numbers range from a small amount will say, you know, 15, 13%, which is kind of right. But the majority of the class will go to 30, 40, 50% sometimes. And that just shows you the disconnect and how visible black people are and how invisible we are at the exact same time. Because black folks only make up roughly under just 14% of the country.
So they're just a little clueless about like what they're actually living inside of. Maybe not a lot of contact with black or brown students.
Yes. And so the idea is, how can you go into a classroom and want to teach black and brown children, but you haven't really been around us? You don't know us. And so trying to get them to understand that they have these blinders on, and what we're going to do is we're going to try and get to this idea. We're going to just try and shut those blinders off.
Okay, so you hit it pretty hard in your piece for Education Week. It was called Dear White Teachers, You Can't Love Your Black Students If You Don't Know Them. So what does it mean to really know your students?
So we talk a lot in ed schools about culture. You got to know your students' culture. You got to be able to talk to your students. But we never tell folks what culture really is. And so I'm not just saying you have to know them and know their reality, because that's not their reality. They didn't have a hand in their reality. And so to know the culture is to know the social, political, educational, economical, spiritual context that your students are living in. And so you need to know the history, right? When we talk about inner city schools, how did these schools become inner city schools? They didn't become inner city overnight. There's a history there. There is a white flight. There's a gutting of resources. And so when I say learn your students' culture, learn who they are, I want you to be a historian almost. So I want you to walk into that community and understand that the people who are there, they didn't have a hand in the poverty or the destruction of that school. That happened 20 years before they got there. And now they're living with that. And so that's where I'm trying to get students to understand. But then on top of that, to see black and brown students' brilliance and compassion and love and joy. I'll give you an example. In Binghamton, New York, I think a month ago, four black girls were strip searched because they appeared to be too happy. They were actually strip searched. And school officials thought that these young girls had drugs on them because they were just happy. And they're 12-year-old girls. And I say, you know, black joy is unrecognizable. How can you strip search four black girls because they appeared happy? And so where do you understand black folks' joy and love in the classroom? Where do we get to see it? So it's not just about knowing our hardships. That's just one story. But you also got to know our love and our resistance and our joy and our passion. That's about knowing the totality of Black and brown folks.
Well, I can imagine teaching, you know, the history of housing policy or the history of education policy in an ed school. How do you teach how to recognize happiness? How do we get beyond this in an education school?
So that's a great question. My final paper in my class this semester is called Black and Brown Excellence. And so my teachers have to write why they are going to teach Black and brown children. What's the joy of that? What's the beauty of that? I want them to tell me. That's their final paper in my class. It's not just about, oh, I want you to look at inequalities in housing, or I want you to look at special education and those numbers. All those things are important. But if you walk into the classroom with all those myths and all those stereotypes about Black and brown children, we kind of reinforce that in teacher education. You have one class, that's a diversity class. That diversity class tells you all the ills and all the and the plight of Black and brown children, all these, and they love to use gap. There's an achievement gap. There's a language gap. There's a word gap. There's an economic gap. And you just sit there for 16 weeks and learn all the gaps. And then you go into a school with all those ideas. You can't just shut that off. And so I really try to refocus that and reframe that and say, okay, yes, those things are there. But what about why you want to teach the joy and love? Let's talk about Black culture. Let's talk about our resiliency and our passion and our love and what we have done throughout history. We have made advancements in every part of American culture. We have gotten the short end of the stick if we've gotten a stick, and we've made advancements. And they have to walk into the classroom and see that brilliance in their students. So that's my final project for them.
Well, this is interesting because, you know, you're talking about understanding culture and character on some level. And as you know, there's a whole chapter in your book devoted to this idea of sort of teaching character, these buzzwords of grit. You know, this is something that's really big in education, business, military, you know, the idea of resilience. You just keep going. And so you do not like this form of curriculum and how it's taught. So what is the basis? How is it taught? And what's your basis for the case of why it should stop?
So I'm not against, let's say, we want kids to have problem-solving skills and to be gritty and to have zest. All those things sound great. And yes, we want kids to be gritty. But you can't have these conversations without an understanding of how racism is deeply inherently in our schools. And so for me, when we think about grit and we think about zest and all of these characteristics they want kids to have, they teach them in a very ahistorical way, as if the kids don't have it. Right. They may not have it in the context of schooling, but history tells us that Black and brown people and people of color in this country have grit. My ancestors built this country for free. I know they have grit. My ancestors went through some of the most hideous conditions that I can't even understand how they were able to survive it. And they did it. And so to have these conversations about grit and about zest and not have any historical understanding of the kids in front of you and where they come from and who raised them, that's deeply problematic. And I find it deeply racist.
My guest is Bettina Love. She's an associate professor of educational theory and practice at the University of Georgia and author of the new book, We Want to Do More Than Survive: Abolitionist Teaching and the Pursuit of Educational Freedom. Let's get to that idea of abolitionist teaching, because your book describes Americans' public school system as the educational survival complex. What do you mean by that?
Right. So, I'm a student and I study the work of Angela Davis. And Angela Davis has been writing for almost 20 years about, you know, this prison industrial complex. And she's also an abolitionist. And so when I looked at schooling and I thought about how schooling is set up, it's set up for Black and brown children only to survive. And you can go all the way back to the Native Americans.
You mean only to fail?
Right. Just to survive.
Right.
But not thrive in those spaces. So you go back to the Native Americans, right? The Carlisle schools, the boarding schools, they cut their hair. They told them that their language, the ways of being, their traditions had to go assimilate. We talk about English only education. That goes back to the 1800s. Separate but equal. All these educational policies, even Brown versus the Board of Education, all these educational policies have been about Black and brown children sitting in schools and trying to survive that place. But then in the backdrop, everybody makes money. So the testing industries make money. The surveillance industries make money. You have a whole idea that black and brown children are deficient. They can't learn. And we're going to make money off that. That black and brown children are violent. And we're going to make money off of that. We're going to put metal detectors in schools. We're going to put dogs into schools. We're going to put police into schools. We're going to put video cameras into schools. We're going to test them and test them. This is billions of dollars. All about making sure that black and brown children never thrive in these places, but they survive these places. And so for me, that's the educational survival complex, very much similar to the prison industrial complex.
So the way that you describe that is that's probably a hard lift to go to a school administrator or, you know, a teacher's association or a PTA, yeah. Never mind the federal government, which works on or wants to, says it's creating federal education policy and saying, you know, you are intentionally wanting kids to fail, black and brown kids to fail. You're making money off of this when mm-hmm. so many school systems are crying poverty. How do you make this case on that level?
So I try to make the case by just giving real life examples about what's happening in our schools. And so we are now experiencing so much violence in our schools where young girls are being thrown in the classroom by their principals. A young girl in Wisconsin was physically assaulted by an acting principal and her hair was ripped out of her head. In Madison, Wisconsin, just last year, 4 teachers and 2 substitutes lost their jobs for racial slurs. And so I'm just going to start, you know, for me, it's to have this conversation, a real life conversation, and tell the stories of what's happening to black and brown students in the country. And how do we reconcile with that? And so one of the big things I talk about in the book is, you know, we got to get big money out of education. The testing industry has to get out of education. We cannot keep going in this direction where they're making billions of dollars. Surveillance, police, therapists, we need counselors, we need healers in our schools. We can't keep going in this direction. And so the case has to be made on a state-to-state, district-to-district, school-to-school case. And that's for me, that's why our abolitionists are so important.
Because of the organization, the way yep. that it spread. But abolitionist movement, you know, of course, was found with, we've got the famous, the Frederick Douglasses mm-hmm. and those who'd experienced slavery. But there was a widespread movement with white people,
that's
too.
Right.
So what is the role? I mean, we talked earlier about mm-hmm. the inequity of teaching, or if you don't really understand, if you only know the gaps, how do you really teach people? What is the role of people who are, you know, God, I hate to say this, well-meaning white people,
yeah.
because that casts a whole shadow of how people behave and their motivations.
Right. And that's why the book calls for abolitionist teaching. I'm originally from upstate New York, Rochester, New York, and that's the home of Frederick Douglass. I grew up miles from where Frederick Douglass wrote the North Star. And so I wanted to talk about what abolitionists did. I think we're in a moment where many people are talking about abolishing this and abolishing that, but we're not talking about who were abolitionists. And abolitionists were everyday people, just like you and me, teachers, reporters, farmers, bankers, lawyers. They were everyday people, white, black, Native American. And they all got together and said, enough is enough. And we're going to take a risk for somebody. You know, I tell people all the time, abolition didn't have Twitter. There's no Facebook, no Instagram. Somebody came to your house, said something to you, and you knew to put your whole family, your farm, your house on the line for them. Right? The Underground Railroad freed over 100,000 enslaved African Americans. And so how do we get back to an idea of taking risks for other people? Saying that we are going to abolish something and we are all going to work together. And abolitionists, yes, there were folks like Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman, and these are like the canon of abolitionists. But this thing wouldn't happen with everyday people. And these weren't just good-intentioned white people. These were white folks who said, I'm going to take a risk. I'm going to do something about it. I'm not just going to read all the books and go to all the rallies. I'm actually going to take a risk. And that's for me why abolitionists were so important, and to tell their stories and to have conversations about what they did and how they did it. That, you know, that's a big part of the book.
Yeah. In fact, there are a lot of examples I'm thinking of, like, is it St. George's County? The Maryland added a Black Lives Matter curriculum.
Yes.
So, you know, getting something like that passed is monumental, but it is the work of some dedicated individuals. But if you're asking that educators, they must teach about racial violence and oppression and civic engagement in communities in a lasting way. In our culture right now, where there are a number of people or a number of forces that say, like, racism, you know, that's a thing of the past. We don't live like that anymore. Are you asking teachers to take on the role of activists on some level?
Yes. Yes.
Undeniably.
Right. To be a teacher.
Well, so how does that go over in your local school system?
I think every school system is different. But I think we have to get out of the business of seeing teaching as apolitical. Teaching is a political act. You're either teaching something and not teaching something else, but you're making decisions about what you're going to teach children about their history. And so teaching is a political act. And we've gotten away from this idea that being a teacher is somehow being neutral. You're not neutral. You're either teaching about something or you're leaving somebody out. That's not neutral. And so we have to understand that teaching should be a part of your activism. You know, you just can't do this thing. You can't want educational justice from 8 to 3:30. And that's why I call it educational teaching and not, I mean, that's why I call it abolitionist teaching and not abolitionist pedagogy, right? Pedagogy is the art of teaching. But I'm asking for a lifestyle. I'm asking for this to be how you see the world, not just something you do in your classroom. So I'm asking teachers, yes, you should be going to rallies with your students. You should be teaching them. And yes, you may not be able to do these things during the school day because of political affiliations and all of that. I totally understand that. What about after school? What about when we can organize? We have to organize. And that's what abolitionists did. And so there is a time and a place. And maybe at your school, you can't do these things. But to think that we can't talk about race and racism in our schools and sexism in our schools, that's not what civics education is.
Bettina Love, she says, education can't save us. We have to save education. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This is great.
She's a University of Georgia Education Associate Professor. Her new book is called We Want to Do More Than Survive, Abolitionist Teaching and the Pursuit of Educational Freedom. There's more in the book. You can go and take a look at gpbnews.org. Now, we enjoyed having you with us today. Really great speaking with you. We are produced by Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Our engineer is Jesse Neiswanger, and Don Smith, our Dean of Grammar, Amy Kiley, senior producer. We'll see you next time with On Second Thought.